Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. In a dramatic move, President Donald Trump has unexpectedly fired FBI Director James Comey, prompting Democrats to change their tune about Comey and rush to his defense, accusing the administration of a cover-up. What's really going on? Donald Trump and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson met with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov yesterday in Washington, D.C. Will there be U.S.-Russia cooperation over de-escalation zones in Syria? Turkey has reacted angrily to the news that the Trump administration has agreed to provide heavy weapons to the Kurdish forces fighting in Syria. How much more stress can the U.S.-Turkey relationship take? But first, we turn to the dramatic firing of FBI Director James Comey. We are joined from Maryland by legendary NSA whistleblower William Binney, and from New York by Ted Rawl, editorial cartoonist and columnist. Welcome back, Ted and Bill.
All right. Thanks for having me back.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you for joining us. I want to start. We're going to talk about James Comey's firing. Very dramatic, dominating the news for the last 2 days. I want to start, though, with a clip first from Hillary Clinton about James Comey, and then a clip from Donald Trump. These were earlier clips when they had what appears to be completely different positions about the now fired FBI director than today. Let's hear first from Hillary Clinton.
I'm sure that some of you may have heard about a letter that the FBI director sent out yesterday. Well, if you're like me, you probably have a few questions about it. It is pretty strange. It's pretty strange to put something like that out with such little information right before an election. In fact, it's not just strange, it's unprecedented, and it is deeply troubling.
That was Hillary Clinton. Now let's hear a clip from Donald Trump at a campaign rally reacting to the same development that Hillary Clinton was obviously complaining about. And of course, later she blamed James Comey for her having lost the November election. Let's listen to Donald Trump, same time period.
It took guts for Director Comey to make the move that he made in light of the kind of opposition he had, where they're trying to protect her from criminal prosecution. You know that.
Ted Rawl, let's start with you. Of course, the juxtaposition couldn't be more profound. That was Hillary Clinton condemning Comey, Donald Trump praising him. Now they've reversed positions. The Democrats are asserting that Trump's firing of Comey is a dramatic effort to cover up or stop the so-called Russia election meddling investigation. Talk about the politics of all of this.
Well, you know, it reminds me of sometimes when I talk to my 13-year-old son, I remind him that I'm stupid, but I'm not a total moron. I think Donald Trump has assumed that the American people are stupid, and he may well be right about that. There's a lot to back that up. And everybody remembers that throughout the campaign, he was very happy with what Mr. Comey did, and he definitely was very grateful for the apparent effect that it had against Hillary's campaign. And without even arguing about whether or not he should have done it, he certainly was pleased. And when he came into power, he basically gave a high five to Comey in the Oval Office in a very famous video. And it's also known that conversely, if Hillary Clinton had gotten in, many top Democrats expected or at least wanted her to dismiss Mr. Comey. So it's clear that if you're looking for a reason to get rid of Comey and you're Donald Trump, saying that you're doing it because he misbehaved related to Hillary Clinton and the investigation into her emails and the way he handled it, flip-flopping on whether or not there would be an investigation, is pretty much the last reason that makes any sense or that's likely to fly with the American people and much less the media.
Bill Binney, your take.
Well, I mean, I thought Comey should have been fired a long time ago because of his inappropriate public discussion of a case or any investigation. I mean, he should never have discussed that publicly. And that's why I thought he should have been fired. So I agree basically with the Attorney General and the Assistant Attorney General recommending his firing. So, I mean, you know, that should have been done a long time ago, though.
Right. And what about the politics? Because you have the Democrats who were attacking Comey before. They're now like all about defending Comey because Trump fired him. They're making the argument that Comey was the one who was in charge of the investigation of Russia's purported or alleged hacking or meddling into the U.S. election, and that this was simply a cover-up by Trump to stop the investigation. What do you think about that argument?
Well, I mean, I just see that Comey was overseeing the investigation. He wasn't doing the investigation. The people who are doing that investigation are still in the FBI and still involved in that process. So, I mean, whoever is the head of the FBI will be reported to. If it was Comey, it would have been Comey. If it's the next person, it will be the next person. So those people are not the ones involved in pulling together the evidence or assessing that evidence. That will be done and reported up the chain, up to the director of the FBI, whoever that is.
And your position is, Bill Binney, that James Comey should have been fired earlier. Just talk about that a little bit from your point of view as a former official in the NSA.
My problem with Comey has been since 2004, when they had the hospital visit about the Stellar Wind program, which is the domestic spying program internally in the United States by NSA, but, you know, also sponsored and by the FBI. They knew that all of this was unconstitutional violation of the First and Fourth Amendment, and then they carried it and used it to prosecute people. And so it was a violation of also the Fifth and Sixth Amendments of the Constitution. They knew that from actually 2001. Director Mueller said they were doing that and using that information from 2001 on. He gave an interview to Bart Gellman, and he said that. So, I mean, it was very clear that these people knew they were violating the Constitution. That's why they were keeping it all secret and hidden. So we had a hidden government, a secret government operating behind the scenes with nobody really in Congress knowing except for a very few people, the Gang of Eight, and that was about it. So all of those people, in my view, should have been indicted and fired. I mean, after all, we did the same thing with Richard Nixon. We got rid of him and for the same reasons.
Ted Rall, let's talk about the politics of what's going on. It's unbelievable here in Washington right now. There is, you know, virtually a political civil war going on. It involves the intelligence agencies and the White House. It involves, of course, the Democratic Party, which has been arguing that Donald Trump was the Manchurian candidate of Vladimir Putin, that Russia tilted the election, that both parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, have joined together for this investigation. I listened to NPR yesterday, and I have to say that their reporting went just like this. It was the 12 noon report. It said, one day after Donald Trump fired James Comey, who was the FBI director overseeing the investigation into possible links between the Trump campaign and Russia, Donald Trump met with a top Russian official. And that was the headline. But of course, he was meeting with Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov in a long-planned visit in the White House. In other words, it seems to me that we're in an atmosphere where Trump is doing what he's trying to do, which is to shut down, I think, perhaps the investigation, which he's feeling threatened by. And the Democrats are involved in nothing less than an all-out Russian, anti-Russian witch hunt and trying to present Trump as nothing other than a stooge of the Russians. And again, I think that's preposterous.
It is preposterous. However, my instincts tell me that the Democrats are going to come out of this neither party has any glory shed on them debacle smelling a little better than the Republicans. Trump, first of all, has the burden of history. This smells and looks like and echoes back to the Saturday Night Massacre carried out by Richard Nixon when he was trying to shake the Watergate investigation being conducted by the FBI and the Attorney General and firing top law enforcement officials. And it just looks and seems like that to any journalist. And I think at this point, This marks a turning point for him because it's really not, the media hasn't been his fan, but now the media is going to sink their teeth into him, and they're not likely to let go more than a pit bull will. And so, yeah, if this is the last of it and there's no more behavior like this, it's not going to lead to impeachment or anything. But knowing Donald Trump and just studying his temperament, it's probably not the last of this sort of authoritarian move that we're going to see. So this is a turning point in his administration that we're going to look back in a year or so and say, okay, this is where things really started to fall apart, I think. The media's had it out for him, I think, and even more interestingly, moderate centrist Republicans who were never quite Trumpists are starting to turn against him and started turning against him on Twitter within hours of his announcement. He drove it. He made the decision. He owned it. The Democrats, as you say, you know, frankly, don't have much moral room to stand on. But their narrative is likely to fly, I think, a little bit higher in the sky than the Republican narrative, than Trump's narrative is going to. I shouldn't say the Republican narrative, but Trump's narrative. And even the Russian bashing is likely to work. I have very educated and savvy journalistic colleagues who keep asking me about the Russians, and I keep asking, where is the evidence? There's still not an iota of evidence that Russia interfered in the U.S. election. And I think it'd be one hell of a story. It just hasn't surfaced. And I'm sorry, some guy in the CIA says it happened is not proof to me.
Bill Binney, you're...
Yeah, I agree totally with what Ted is saying. Except I would never compare it with the Tuesday night massacre, or whatever it was back with Nixon, simply because back when the Nixon firing occurred, there was ample evidence that he was doing both publicly as well as internally in the FBI and the Congress that he was doing unconstitutional acts. So there was ample evidence of it there. That's why he fired him. And right now, I have never seen or heard of any evidence at all from anybody about the Russian interference, what it was, what they did. You know, none of that has been said. We just get everybody's opinion. Well, I'm not interested in opinions. I need to know a fact. Give me a fact to something I can believe, because most of these people lie to you all the time, so I can't really believe any of them.
Yeah. And just for our younger audience, when we're talking about Richard Nixon, what happened was after the Watergate break-in, where Republican Party operatives broke into the Democratic Party offices and stole files, trying to undermine the campaign of George McGovern. And when all of that started to come out, which, by the way, came out because of so-called Deep Throat, which turned out to be the FBI working with the Washington Post to undermine the Nixon administration. Under those circumstances, a special prosecutor was appointed, Archibald Cox, and Nixon ordered the attorney general to fire Archibald Cox. And the attorney general resigned rather than do it. And then the deputy attorney general also refused to fire the special prosecutor. And that's how this sort of Archibald Cox Nixonian sort of comparison comes about. But let's go back, Ted Rall, to what actually happened. That was a situation where you had the FBI actually, or operatives within the FBI, working to bring down Nixon. I mean, we are in a situation of, it seems to me, of internal sort of political civil war within the summits of the U.S. political establishment. And in other words, instability rather than stability reigns supreme.
Well, that's right. Because, you know, when I wrote my book, Trump, last year about him, on the back cover, the copy says, you know, this is about the hostile takeover of the Republican Party by Donald Trump. And that's exactly what he pulled off. And this is part of the aftermath of that fact. You've got a guy, I mean, Donald Trump, sure, is a conservative, and obviously he is really governing as a classic hard right conservative in every way. In every respect, he's indistinguishable, really, from Ronald Reagan, except in temperament and style. But politically and policy-wise, he's exactly the same. But in terms of the structure of the GOP, they're not looking at things that way. They process this as they didn't expect this guy to be the nominee. They wanted Jeb Bush or perhaps Marco Rubio and, God forbid, possibly Ted Cruz, but certainly not this guy to be the nominee and to become president. They're a little bit pleased because he won despite the fact that they really thought he was going to lose to Hillary. And so, you know, they're along for the ride. But now you're seeing all these internal divisions within the GOP playing themselves out. Trump has not been a canny politician. He hasn't brought the Republican Party together. And that coalition is falling, is fracturing within the bureaucracy. And there's also the kind of the, I guess, something we're going to see in France under Emmanuel Macron, where you have a guy who doesn't have traditional control of a political party, despite being the Republican Party nominee. He doesn't have the deep control that a Jeb Bush would have had. So he's kind of a man, a president without a party, or I should say maybe with half a party. And it's political civil war.
Bill Binney, the day before the firing, Donald Trump tweeted about the ongoing Russia investigation saying, quote, "The Russia-Trump collusion story is a total hoax. When will this taxpayer-funded charade end?" Now, that was the day before the firing. So you would think that he's obviously thinking about it and he's angry about it. Democrats are alleging Comey was fired to cover up collusion. You say the investigation goes on anyway. It seems to me that it probably will put more pressure on the administration or on Congress to appoint a special prosecutor. But here's Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer, who also used to condemn Comey, now defending him. He spoke to Trump and told him he was, quote, about the firing, quote, making a very big mistake, and added that an independent investigation into Moscow's role in the election is now the only way to go to restore the American people's faith. Now, the American people's faith has been completely, if it exists, has been completely manipulated, it seems to me, by the unproven assertions in the mainstream media. But just your take, because you were there during the Nixon era, do you think we're going towards a special prosecutor?
Well, I wouldn't have any problem doing a special prosecutor either. I mean, but I would say you can't really stop there. You have to investigate the FBI and what happened in the Hillary Clinton affair. Because after all, this guy, Comey, came out there and said there wasn't enough evidence for any prosecutor to prosecute him, when in fact he went right down the line and listed all kinds of felonies for which a lot of whistleblowers are currently in jail. I mean, come on, give me a break. That's why I began calling our Department of Justice the Department of Just Us, because they had basically a double standard of how they applied the law. I figure we should open this up and go after everybody, because a lot of these people on both sides, Republicans and Democrats, are criminals. And I think we ought to let it all out and go after them all. So let's do that.
All right. A new sort of maybe a Democratic moment under those circumstances. That was Bill Binney. He's the legendary NSA whistleblower. We've been talking to him from Maryland and also from New York City by Ted Rall, editorial cartoonist and columnist. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Donald Trump and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson met with the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov yesterday in Washington, D.C. Will there be U.S.-Russia cooperation over so-called de-escalation zones in Syria? We are joined from Baltimore by Kevin Zeis. He is the co-director of Popular Resistance. That's popularresistance.org. Welcome back, Kevin.
Thanks for having me on, Brian.
Thank you for joining. How significant was Lavrov's visit? I mean, of course, the timing was dramatic because the firing of James Comey. It was a surprise that Trump met with him. At least that's the way the media portrayed it, although that might have been long planned and not simply a meeting between Lavrov and his counterpart, Secretary of State Tillerson. Well, anyway, what do you make of it?
Well, I think it's good to see an ongoing dialogue between Russia and the United States. This is the second meeting that Tillerson has had with Lavrov, and they're talking now about Trump and Putin actually having a face-to-face at a meeting this summer, you know, alongside an international meeting. And I think that's all very good. And I thought Lavrov handled it very well when a reporter shouted to him about Comey being fired. He says, "What? What? He's been fired? You must be kidding. You must be kidding." I thought that was making a joke out of it. I think it was Lavrov is such a professional. Turn that into something not that important. And the more important really is that Russia and the United States talk to each other. A lot of problem areas around the world, Syria, Iraq, ISIS, Crimea and the Ukraine, the whole border with Russia and the U.S. and Europe, the NATO border, so and the whole nuclear issue, nuclear weapons. So there are a lot of issues that if they start talking to each other, they could do some tremendous good. And, you know, throughout his campaign, Trump said he wanted a kind of detente with Russia. He wanted to make deals rather than have conflict. I think that was very popular with a lot of the people who voted for him. The whole Russiagate controversy, I think, has stifled that, and that's unfortunate. There has never been any kind of proof of a Trump-Putin plan to control the election outcome. And so it's a shame that that's really been stifling the discussion. I think this Comey firing, I think, by Trump was a tremendous error. I think he now has created a lot of doubt in people who were questioning the Russiagate stuff. You know, what's he trying to hide? What's he covering up? Why is anyone coming to continue the investigation? You know, and it's coming at the time when, his former national security advisor, people around here are being subpoenaed. It's coming at a time when investigations are heating up. And so it really raises questions more that could have been put to rest if Trump had just been patient and let this run its course. But now I think it's going to escalate now, and that could block this dialogue further.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think that the Democrats, I think the position of the Democrats who, you know, used to condemn Comey because they said he and Putin were responsible for the loss of Hillary Clinton, which is just so amazing when you think that Hillary Clinton never visited Wisconsin, didn't just took Wisconsin for granted, lots of other reasons. But anyway, that aside, what seems to get lost here too is that what Lavrov was saying in the press conference is that the de-escalation zones in Syria, which could be a recipe for the incremental sort of settlement of the war in big parts of Syria, and everybody up until now, all the Democrats and Republicans hypocritically said they care so much about Syrians, and so many Syrians have died and so many Syrians have been made into refugees. But now you have, as a consequence of these processes that are being put into place, the minimizing of the conflict and possibly the end of the conflict. That seems to be like, oh, who cares about that? But what Lavrov was actually saying, and it was interesting, I thought, he said, well, this idea of the de-escalation zones was an American idea. In other words, he was sort of, because of course Trump and Pence and the rest of them had been, and Hillary Clinton too, had been calling for, quote, safe zones in Syria. It seems to me that the Russian orientation is to say, look, we're trying to bring the American government in, which, of course, in the past, the American government had been saying Assad must go, Assad must go, Assad must go. Now that that's not going to happen, and it's clear, bring America in, find a way to actually end the Syrian war. I mean, if that were to happen, and I'm not talking about for us to judge whether the de-escalation zones are good or what the politics of all of those things are, but just the end of the war under those circumstances would be so welcomed by the Syrians.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting direction. You know, before Trump was elected, the Russians were negotiating with a group of other countries, Turkey, Iran, and they were trying to figure out a peace process. But you can't do it without the United States. And before the election, when Hillary was talking about no-fly zones, that would have been very dangerous if the Russians were not involved, because the Russians are flying and no-fly zones. And so that starts a conflict with Russia. But now that you're seeing Tillerson and Lavrov talking, and the safe zones is a joint project where, you know, both Russia and the U.S., and I assume other parties that are allied with both countries, will join in, then you are starting to have countries working together toward bringing peace initially in certain areas and potentially much more widely. And if the, you know, countries get together to talk about, you know, really putting together a peace process where Syria gets back control of its borders, where foreign governments, you know, step back, and, you know, where there are, you know, future elections that at some point that, you know, Assad will face another election, and those are internationally monitored, the country could pick whoever they want as president, whether it's Assad or not. But it's the country making the choice. It's a sovereign country making the choice. And the U.S. has a long history of trying to select for Syria. And I hope that that does not come back up again. And the U.S. lets the Syrians pick for Syria. And That's the process, and I think these safe zones are a good initial step.
The Obama administration was also involved in the Geneva peace talks for Syria, and there appeared to be an agreement between Russia and the United States, John Kerry and Lavrov then, and there was a plan to begin the incremental carrying out of ceasefire agreements in different areas. And there was a debate within the Obama administration about whether it was the Obama administration should endorse it or not. And ultimately, it did endorse it. Ash Carter did not endorse it. He was the Secretary of Defense. The Uniformed Officer Corps in the Pentagon did not endorse it either. They made it clear publicly that they didn't like it. And then one or two days after it was announced, the Pentagon bombed Syrian government army positions, fixed positions, and killed a lot of Syrian soldiers. And that then sort of scuttled the agreement. Now it appears Trump seems to want to do this. But what about the Pentagon? I mean, without the Pentagon's support, because they seem to be the real power in Washington, it won't happen. What do you think about all that?
Well, this is a long-term problem in the United States. I remember reading about even JFK unable to control his military in that era, and the Russians, the Soviets at the time, being aware of it. And so now we're seeing this continue, and since that time, it's gotten worse. The Pentagon does have a lot of power, and will they listen to Trump? Will can Trump be the commander-in-chief and actually tell them to stand down when a peace agreement's reached? That remains to be seen. And Trump has surrounded himself with militarists, generals, and put them into civilian positions even, including the Secretary of Defense, who is a former General Mattis, who had to get a waiver in order to be Secretary of Defense. So it's a big question that remains to be seen. And if Trump can't control the military, and the military does like it did under the Obama administration and violate a peace agreement, a ceasefire, then we're going to have these problems. And how do you get around that? I wish there was I had some magic idea where the Pentagon could be really put under civilian control and do what it's ordered to do. But that's what's essential. And we need to get that kind of situation in hand where there is a president who actually controls his military.
Lavrov was also asked, or the media was shouting questions at him about U.S. Sanctions and other European sanctions, which were demanded by the U.S. against Russia about Ukraine and the election, the referendum that took place in Crimea to affiliate with Russia, which the United States calls just a land grab by Russia and an annexation. But Lavrov responded, "We don't discuss sanctions. It's not our problem. It is one-sided actions taken against us." Do you think there's any chance that the Trump administration would lift sanctions on Russia?
I found Lavrov's answer very interesting. The fact that I think it was a real effort to downplay it and to take some of the pressure off, because there is efforts in Congress, for example, to prevent Trump from being able to remove sanctions. So I think it was very smart, Lavrov, to back off that and say, that's a U.S. decision, not ours. Yes, I do think that if this relationship develops, and they really start to talk about the various areas of potential conflict between Russia and the United States, those conflicts can be solved. It requires the United States to stand in Russia's shoes on something like Crimea and also over the NATO border in Europe and see where Russia's standing. Because I think if the U.S. can see that, they'll see that the U.S. has been the aggressor and Russia has been playing defense. And in Crimea, that occurred at a time of a coup that was heavily supported by the United States, had been building an opposition civil society for many years through USAID and NED. They picked a president who was selected by Ukraine, was someone who was a State Department informant since 2006. There are WikiLeaks documents that our State Department cables, that I think he was called our man in Ukraine by the State Department, because he was an informant for the State Department. Yatsenyuk was the one that was picked over the telephone
by Victoria Nuland.
Exactly, and our ambassador. They said it's Yats, and that's who became prime minister. And then, of course, the finance minister is a longtime State Department employee. who came to Ukraine after the Orange Revolution and stayed, and she started to stay as a State Department employee. Then she started a hedge fund or a finance investment fund, and reportedly a lot of the money that the CIA and the United States, USAID, funneled into the Ukraine went through her fund. And then on the day she became finance minister, Poroshenko made her a Ukraine citizen, and then she became finance minister. So the United States was controlling the prime minister, the president, and the finance minister. And Kerry's son, Biden's son, was on the board of the largest private energy company. Kerry's longtime finance partner was also on that board. And so the United States really moved in and took control. So that, and it was at the same time they were working with these the Western Ukrainians who have a very strong bent towards supporting Hitler and have a very anti-Russian. And one of the first laws they put forward was one that would punish people who spoke the Russian language. And of course, Crimea is a primarily Russian-speaking place and primarily a Russian population. So they were afraid. And at the same time, the Russians have a long-time Navy base in Crimea, and they needed to protect that. So that was a marriage that made sense for the Crimean people to be protected from Kiev and for Russia to protect its military base. So, and that was then affirmed by a vote. So that was the situation that was going on. So now if Trump could look at that with fresh eyes and see what was going on, and he says he's opposed to regime change operations. That was a U.S. regime change operation. If he can see that issue can be dealt with, and Russia's put forward ideas on how that can be dealt with, where the eastern Ukraine can have some independence but still be part of Ukraine. So there are solutions there. So I think all the problems that we face with Russia do have solutions, but they require the United States to step back a little bit and look at themselves more honestly. Is the U.S. capable of that? Is the Pentagon capable of that? Those are lots of big questions, but that's what really needs to happen. The real aggressor in these situations is the United States, and Russia is playing defense. And the same is true in Syria, where the U.S. has been trying to remove Assad, the current Assad and the previous Assad, the Assad family, for many years. Again, Russia is playing defense, and so if the U.S. can see that, these are all very solvable problems. Can the U.S. see that? I don't know the answer.
We're speaking with Kevin Zeese. You can see his writings at his website, popularresistance.org. I think the facts that, as you've laid them out very, very well, Kevin, are really what's missing from the U.S. mainstream media presentation about Ukraine or Syria. I think what you laid out is absolutely what happened in Ukraine. And Crimea was always a part of Russia. It only was transferred administratively to Ukraine in 1954 by Nikita Khrushchev, when Ukraine and Russia were part of the same country, the Soviet Union. And Russia and Ukraine was the second biggest republic in the Soviet Union and a historic, most important partner for Russia, and the place through which the Nazis invaded Russia, at the beginning of World War II. So the idea that Ukraine could have a Western-sponsored, U.S.-sponsored coup d'etat and this Russians would lose their naval base in the Black Sea, and these Russian parts of the country would be taken over by anti-Russian fascists. I mean, that was untenable. I think those facts are important. We have 2 minutes left. I want to stay with this for a second. Well, not this, but in other words, the atmosphere here in Washington. Senator Lindsey Graham said about the Trump-Lavrov meeting, he said this. Now, Lindsey Graham, of course, is a Republican senator. The president meeting with Lavrov today, it's okay to want to work with the Russians, but I hope, Mr. President, you know who you're dealing with. You're dealing with a man who represents a government that is brutal, that tried to undermine our elections, and be careful. These are not teddy bears you're dealing with. I mean, it's just so, so offensive that all of these politicians on both sides of the aisle can just use Russia as a punching bag. They're really demonizing Russia in a way the way they demonized Gaddafi before the invasion of Libya or Saddam before the invasion of Iraq. I mean, it's the politics of demonization, which seems to be the dominant narrative here in Washington.
Well, Lindsey Graham is pretty well known as an anti-Russia senator and very hawkish in many of his views on multiple countries. So you have to take him with a grain of salt with that in mind. And demonization and propaganda are two very common things in the United States. And I've been kind of amazed by the long-time demonization of Russia during the Obama administration as well, and obviously continuing with the whole concept of Russia determining the outcome of our election, which I don't see any proof of. It's just such a fanciful tale. But so we have a lot to overcome on that propaganda. People are really convinced, and it's very hard, even though we have a large social media where people can, you know, put out their own information. We have an independent media. The corporate mass media still dominates, and they tend to put out propaganda, and they do it along with people in the government. The bipartisans in the government, the leadership of both parties, work with the corporate media, put out the message that they want to get out. And so more and more Americans realize that and consider it something they can't trust.
Yeah, fake news isn't just a little niche category. Fake news could be the dominant mainstream media here in America. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been joined from Baltimore by Kevin Zeese. He's the co-director of Popular Resistance. You can see their website at popularresistance.org. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Turkey has reacted angrily to the news that the Trump administration has agreed to provide heavy weapons to the Kurdish forces fighting in Syria. What will it mean for U.S.-Turkish relations? Turkey, of course, being the eastern flank of the U.S. military alliance, NATO. We are joined from New York City by journalist Ben Norton. He is a contributor to the Alternet's Gray Zone project. Welcome back, Ben.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Ben, I want to play a clip that we have from Sean Spicer, world-renowned press spokesperson for the Trump White House, about this question. Let's hear it.
Yesterday, the president authorized the Department of Defense to equip Kurdish elements of the Syrian Democratic Forces as necessary to ensure a clear victory over ISIS in Raqqa, Syria. The SDF, partnered with enabling support from U.S. and coalition forces, are the only force on the ground that successfully seize Raqqa in the near future. We're keenly aware of the security concerns of our coalition partners in Turkey. We want to reassure the people and the government of Turkey that the U.S. is committed to preventing additional security risks and protecting our NATO ally.
Okay, so that was a little bit of, you know, diplomatic parlance, but the White House is fully aware that the Erdogan government would denounce this move by the United States. Why is the United States arming the Kurds right now?
Well, this is, of course, a campaign to take Raqqa. Raqqa is the de facto capital of ISIS, and it's the most important city to retake. There's been, for several months now, a campaign to retake Mosul, which is going somewhat successfully, although, you know, there have been hundreds and perhaps thousands of civilian casualties. And Raqqa is the other major offensive that was recently launched by largely Kurdish forces. So the U.S. is in this incredibly contradictory relationship where it wants to ally with both NATO member Turkey, which is carrying out a war against the Kurds and ostensibly also against ISIS, and then also at the same time wage a war against ISIS. And this has put the U.S. on both sides for months now since Turkey militarily intervened in mid-2016 without the consent of the Syrian government. Turkey has been carrying out a campaign of airstrikes in the north of the country, but those airstrikes have been aimed not just at ISIS. It is true that that Turkey has beaten back some ISIS forces, but it has also been fighting Kurdish forces, which are also fighting ISIS. So the U.S. is in this very contradictory relationship, and of course the Trump administration is continuing this going forward where, you know, they want to have the best of both worlds. And of course, Turkey, which sees the Kurds, frankly, as a bigger threat than ISIS. Turkey was playing a double game for some years. It was allowing ISIS to cross its borders. And then ISIS began attacking Turkey when Turkey was allowing the U.S. to use its Incirlik air base in the south. So, you know, there's a very contradictory relationship, and this just continues to underscore it.
Let's help the audience understand, especially the audience that isn't from the Middle East or isn't Kurdish or isn't Syrian Arab, understand what the issues are here. Help the audience understand who the Kurds are as a people. And what the Kurds who are in Syria, the Kurdish People's Protection Units, or the YPG, What are they really fighting for?
Yes, well, the Kurds are they're a minority group in the Middle East. However, they're a pretty large minority group, and they are primarily located in southern Turkey, in western and northern Iraq, and in northern Syria. And there's an entire region there. It's not an official country. It's not an official state, but Kurds sometimes refer to it as Kurdistan. In 1916, when Western colonial powers arbitrarily divided up the Middle East in the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which was later exposed after the Bolshevik Revolution, the Kurds were not given a nation and a nation state in the way that other people were. And for decades, Kurds in these countries have been fighting for independence in an autonomous region. In northern Iraq, Kurds essentially already have an autonomous zone that is recognized, and it's not necessarily on good relations with the Kurds in the north of Syria and south Turkey. There are different dialects of the Kurdish language, and they're not necessarily fighting each other, but not necessarily close allies. And in northern Syria, since the war in Syria began in 2011, there have been Kurds that have essentially kind of been a separate arm of the conflict. In general, the Kurdish forces tend to be more sympathetic to the Syrian government and ally more with the Syrian government, mostly, especially in recent years, because the armed opposition to the Syrian government has been dominated by extremist Islamist groups, which are largely anti-Kurdish. However, the Kurds, unlike the Syrian government, are also pushing for an autonomous region in the north. And this has added a complex layer to the conflict in Syria that is often not addressed that much. And then the U.S., of course, has been on multiple sides. The U.S. has been trying to topple the Syrian government, but it's also been supporting Kurdish forces, which are fighting ISIS. And there are even divisions within the Kurdish forces. But in general, many of the Kurdish fighters are pushing for an autonomous region in the north. And Turkey is vehemently opposed to this. Turkey has been trying to turn the north, in fact, to a kind of sphere of influence. And we see, again, what this contradiction is, where, different segments of the U.S. state are on different sides. And now the Trump administration is arming Kurds while arming and supporting Turkey, its NATO ally, which is fighting them.
The Kurds, as you mentioned, were excluded by the colonial powers. Britain and France divided up the Middle East, the former Ottoman Empire, between themselves. And it would have also included Tsarist Russia, except Tsarist Russia was no more because the Bolsheviks had taken power in the October Revolution. And the policy of the Bolsheviks was to expose all secret imperialist treaties. And they exposed Sykes-Picot, whereby the Arab people and the other peoples of the region were essentially just pawns in British and French colonial chessboard. So then you have – so that's how we know about the Sykes-Picot is because, as you alluded to, because of the Bolshevik revelation about it. But today there are 30 to 32 million, perhaps as many as 35 million Kurds. The largest concentration of Kurds is in the eastern part of Turkey, and they have a contiguous territory with some parts of northern Turkey. They have a northern border or a southern border with the northern part of Syria. The Turkish government, Erdogan, fears that there could be, if there's an autonomous zone for Kurds in Syria, that that will be in a way an extension of the PKK, the Kurdish group in Turkey, in their demand for not only autonomy but potentially independence. In other words, the Turkish government sees in this possibility the prospect for the possible dismemberment of Turkey. And so they have approached the Kurds as terrorists because of that. Is that how you see it?
Well, there are so many contradictions in this. The U.S. has at various times allied itself with the Kurds, which is interesting, especially during the Cold War, because the Kurds are largely dominated by socialist political groupings. The PKK is a revolutionary socialist party, and the YPG in northern Syria, for those who don't know, the PKK is located in Turkey. And since the 1980s, the PKK and other Kurdish resistance groups, most of which have been Marxist-Leninist, have been waging a war of liberation against the Turkish government, which has viciously repressed the Kurdish minority for decades. And in the northern part of Syria, the YPG and other political groupings are technically independent, but they're also, you know, socialist. And the U.S., which of course has been the leading anti-socialist force in the world since, you know, the Bolshevik Revolution 100 years ago, at various times, however, as a form of realpolitik, the U.S. has sided with the Kurds, but it has also betrayed the Kurds multiple times. And so there are many fears that while the U.S. is supporting the Kurds now while they're fighting ISIS, as soon as ISIS is defeated, the U.S. may betray them again and side with Turkey. So, you know, the Kurds are in a precarious situation. And I think, yeah, you articulated it very well, what the situation is. You know, many of the Kurds fighting in the north are fighting against ISIS and do plan on creating some kind of autonomous region. And in the southern part of Turkey, you know, for decades, they have been fighting for this kind of autonomous region. And Turkey sees this as part of the same war. And Turkey, of course, has been militarily intervening and supporting rebels in Syria since the beginning of the conflict, essentially. You know, journalists inside Turkey have been imprisoned for exposing how the Erdogan government was giving weapons to hardline Islamist extremists. So it's a really complex situation, and it's hard to tell what the U.S. will end up doing. But to me, if you ask my opinion, I think what will probably happen, unfortunately, is that the U.S. will do what it has done to the Kurds in the past. You know, Kissinger famously, the war criminal who, you know, Hillary Clinton was applauding in her presidential campaign, former Secretary of State, Kissinger previously called on the Kurds to launch an armed uprising against Saddam Hussein and said that the U.S. would provide support. And then the U.S. did not do so. And then they were, you know, slaughtered by Saddam Hussein. And I personally think that as soon as ISIS is kicked out of Raqqa and maybe not completely defeated, but reduced to, you know, a significantly smaller force, I do have the impression that the U.S. will probably allow Turkey to continue fighting the Kurds. It's hard to tell what could happen.
One of the things that you can see on the horizon, especially as Donald Trump has supported safe zones, he did that in the 2016 campaign, so did Mike Pence. He's done that since he became president. And now the Russians appear to have also agreed that there should be what are called de-escalation zones, which may be considered safe zones. Nobody knows ultimately whether these safe zones or de-escalation zones ultimately, should the war end, whether those who are the dominant military force in those areas will then become the political power in those areas. In other words, what could conceivably happen, and I think the Syrian government fears that this will happen, is that if that's the negotiated settlement of the conflict, that perhaps the Kurds would have an autonomous zone more or less in a federalized Syria. In other words, a slightly partitioned Syria, or at least a Syria where the central government is considerably weaker. And then, of course, you would have a situation where the Kurds, having fought all these battles, won't want to give up the authority that they have in those areas. Are you suggesting then that perhaps Turkey would, because of course Turkey has a huge military and Turkey's a big country, that they would maybe follow up with a military action against the Kurds, perhaps then with the blessing of the United States?
Well, it's of course hard to tell. It could go a few different ways. It also depends, I think, on what this Kurdish regional authority looks like. You know, the YPG, as I mentioned, is a revolutionary socialist group. However, there are elements of the Kurds which are supportive of Israel and which are supportive of the U.S. And if the U.S. sees a state, a Kurdish autonomous region or state or whatever it is, the formation is, that is pro-U.S., pro-Israel, you know, this may partially be an attempt by the U.S. to weaken the Syrian government and create an autonomous region that would be allied to it. Because, of course, the Syrian government is not at all a U.S. ally. The U.S. has been trying to overthrow the Syrian government. So that is one possible alternative. I think the other option is if the YPG has an autonomous region. And, I mean, there are there's something called the PYD and SPD, like this Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF. There are many, there's alphabet soup in many different political groupings in the north, but the primary political and military wing is the YPG. If they do create, you know, a kind of revolutionary socialist state, which is possible, or an autonomous region, which is also a possibility, I do think that, you know, Turkey has already demonstrated multiple times, including in the last few weeks, that it's still at war with the Kurds in the north. Turkey a few weeks ago bombed Kurdish forces who were fighting ISIS and killed probably around 100 Kurdish fighters. So I do not think that it's a stretch by any, you know, stretch of the imagination to suspect that Turkey could continue fighting the Kurds if there is some kind of regional agreement, autonomous region created, because Turkey considers the YPG a terrorist organization. It considers it an extension of the PKK, which is considered a terrorist organization by the U.S. So it's hard to tell.
Well, I'm going to ask you the next question because we only have 3 minutes. Regarding to the decision by Trump to send heavy weapons to the Kurds, Prime Minister Binali Yildirim, the Prime Minister of Turkey, said this: "We cannot imagine that the United States making a choice between our strategic level partnership and a terrorist organization. The U.S. administration still has a chance to consider Turkey's sensitivities of the highest level on the PKK. If the decision is taken otherwise, this will surely have consequences and will yield a negative result for the U.S. as well." I want to ask you, one, does this pose the real possibility of the strategic partnership between Turkey and the United States, of course, the western and eastern flanks of NATO, actually ending? And secondly, because we have a shortage of time, the YPG, the Kurds spokesperson, Radir Azil, said of the decision by the Trump administration, "We believe that from now on and after this historic decision, the YPG will play a stronger, more influential, and more decisive role in combating terrorism at a fast pace." Do you think the arming of the Kurds, the second question, will actually be have a significant military impact on the liberation of Raqqa?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, of course, it depends. We don't know the exact details, but the U.S. is going to be sending heavy weapons. And the Kurdish forces have already been leading the fight against ISIS in Raqqa. So I think, you know, this is actually a pretty significant development. But the question is what happens after, right? You know, the U.S. sided with the Soviet Union in World War II. And the Soviet Union did the vast majority of the fighting, killing more than 75% of Nazis who were killed in World War II. And then immediately after the war, the U.S. essentially declared war, a soft war, a cold war on the Soviet Union. So I think this is a possibility for the Kurds. There are other options. I mean, it's hard to tell exactly what will happen because these things are, you know, subject to change very rapidly. But yeah, I think this is a very significant development. I think it shows that the Kurds are probably going to lead the fight against ISIS in Raqqa.
All right, we're going to leave it there. We've been talking with Ben Norton. He's a journalist. He is a contributor to Alternet's Gray Zone project. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.